3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh yeah.
Alternative news, analysis and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your pants.
Good morning, listeners. You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on Monday, the 9th of February, 2026. Joined in the studio with me, Rob, is Izzy. Good morning, Izzy.
Good morning, Rob.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
It is early, early morning.
Oh, yes.
I hope everyone has had a good break and managed to stay out of the wet weather yesterday.
Yes.
I know it didn't exactly get everywhere.
No.
But I stepped out of a V-line.
Yesterday
afternoon, and I like looked up and it was just raining so hard.
Said, hello, Melbourne. Hello.
Yeah, she was saying hello this morning, last night. And then as soon as I got home, it stopped raining.
Yep.
So
it's the weather here will change in 7 minutes,
it's
you know.
Crazy.
You just got to put the timer
crazy.
On and soon it'll be sunny. You know, you just never know. Waking up this morning, it was interesting. I feel like It's already dark earlier in the morning. Like, it kind of feels like summer is almost ending, to be honest with you.
It's bleak.
It's crazy. I feel like it just started.
Yeah. And yet we're still having some of, like, the hottest days.
I know.
Right?
I know. I mean, that 45-degree day, I could never forget it.
Yeah.
That was crazy.
And we'll talk a little bit more about that later.
Yeah.
Because it is the hot weather is actually relevant to one of our segments that we're doing today. But first up, after our headlines, we're going to be listening to an interview from 3CR reporter and, of course, a friend of the show, Amy from Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence, where Keir Patterson, who's the CEO of Community Houses and longtime community volunteer, spoke with Amy Kiara about neighborhood houses and their safety for women and children, community programs, and they also spoke about an upcoming rally and the need for government funding to keep neighborhood houses running. So that's happening first on the show at 7:15. And then after that, we've got the first half of an interview by regular Tuesday Hometime presenter Jan Bartlett's from their first show back after the summer break, where she spoke to Kathy Kelly, who's a veteran US human rights activist, about the climate of fear and intimidation in her country, in particular the recent actions of ICE, and they draw comparisons to Germany in the 1930s. So that's happening after that first segment, which is happening around 7:30, and then at 7:45, which is relevant to the whole weather we were just mentioning. We're going to be speaking with Tamsin from the Fly By Night Bat Clinic, who is going to be telling us about a wave of deaths of flying foxes because of the heat and the very desperate efforts by volunteers to try to save them and rehabilitate those who didn't pass away during the heat.
Wow.
So that's happening at 7:45, and then at 8 o'clock, the last segment of the show, we're going to be speaking with Stephen Roberts, who is a masculinity researcher and professor of sociology at Monash University, and they have co-authored a study about the reanimation of normative manhood acts in schools, Which is, yeah, essentially how the rise of influencers such as Andrew Tate have affected the behavior of boys in schools and how that's played out in their interactions with teachers. So that's happening at 8 o'clock.
Great show.
Yeah, so
jam-packed.
It's all to come. But for now, we will get into our headlines, hey?
Let's do it. Some folks know about it, some don't. Some don't. Some will learn to shout it, some won't. Some won't. But sooner or later, baby, here's a ditty. Say you're gonna have to get right down to the real nitty-gritty. Let's get right down to the real nitty-gritty. Now, one, two, nitty-gritty. Now, yeah, boom, nitty-gritty. Ooh-wee. The nitty-gritty. Right down to the real nitty-gritty. Boop-bop-bop-bop-boop, boop, the nitty-gritty. Ooh-ooh, ooh-ooh. Double-beatin', right down to the nitty-gritty, yeah. Double-beatin', keep repeatin'. These are the new headlines for Monday, the 9th of February, 2025, 2026. Victoria's housing crisis is back in the spotlight this week, with the state government passing new planning laws that could pave the way for more affordable and social housing. The Planning Amendment, Better Decisions Made Faster Bill, has passed both houses of parliament, giving local council and the planning minister new powers to require affordable and social homes in new developments. Community housing advocates have welcomed the move, saying it creates an important new mechanism at a time when Victoria is facing a severe shortage of affordable rentals. The Community Housing Industry Association of Victoria says that more than 146,000 households are currently experiencing homelessness, housing stress, or overcrowding, and warns that strong consultation and regulation will be crucial to make sure the reforms deliver real outcomes. The government is now setting up a stakeholder committee to design how the new requirements will work in practice, with housing organisations saying the real test will be whether the reforms translate into homes on the ground. Also in news this week, this year's World Cancer Day brought new research that revealed deep inequities in Australia's health system, revealing that First Nations Australians are dying at a far higher rate from blood cancer than non-Indigenous peoples. Commissioned by the Leukemia Foundation and led by First Nations researchers at the University of Queensland, the world's first study shows First Nations patients are more likely to die younger, be diagnosed later, and face major barriers to treatment and care. The research draws on the lived experiences of patients, carers, health workers, and community organisations, finding that distance from specialist services, financial strain, lack of culturally safe care, and low awareness of blood cancer symptoms are all contributing to the survival gap. Researchers say the findings exposed systematic failures at every stage of the cancer journey, from diagnosis through to treatment, and warn that without urgent, culturally responsive reform, First Nations lives will be at continued risk.
Also in the news this week, six members of the UK's Palestine Action Group who broke into a factory and destroyed drones to be used by Israel have been acquitted or not convicted of all charges against them. All six were found not guilty of aggravated burglary, which could have led to life sentences, and were held on remand for 17 months as they waited trial. The 24 members of Palestine Action Group, known as the Filton 24, for their break-in, damaged drones in a factory in Filton near Bristol in England's west, which is owned by a subsidiary of Elbit Systems, Israel's largest weapons manufacturer. Campaigners told the electronic intifada that the result was a, quote, monumental and total victory, end quote. Following this, the other members of what's known as the Filton 24 will appeal to be released on bail. Prisoners are usually held on remand for 6 months in the UK, but the politicisation of the case, including the UK government's labelling of the Palestine Action Group as a terrorist group, meant that some have been held in jail for 17 months as they waited trial.
And lastly, global sports leaders, including the International Olympic Committee, say they have reached an agreement on a new framework to guide gender eligibility in elite sport, a move that comes amid an ongoing and deeply politicized backlash against transgender and gender-diverse athletes. While the IOC has framed the policy as an attempt to bring consistency across sports, human rights organizations have long pointed out that transgender athletes are already vastly underrepresented in elite sport, yet face disproportionate scrutiny, exclusion, and public hostility, often without being consulted or centered in decisions that directly affect their lives. The IOC has said the framework is intended to be grounded in human rights and inclusion, stating that sports should be accessible to everyone. But critics argue that unless trans and gender diverse people are meaningfully involved in shaping these policies, they risk reinforcing the very discrimination they claim to avoid. As attacks on trans rights escalates globally, advocates say community support matters more than ever, and that sport should be a place of belonging, joy, and participation, not another arena where trans people are erased, regulated, or pushed out. These have been the headlines for Monday, the 9th of February. You're listening to 3CR on 855 AM.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Thank you. overtime.
The Common Social Change Library is an online collection of educational resources for those involved in community campaigns and social and labour movements. It collects, curates, and distributes key lessons and resources from progressive movements from around Australia and across the globe. The library includes over 1,400 resources covering campaign strategy, community organising, activist history, digital campaigning, justice, equity, diversity and inclusion, and much, much more. It's free to access the library, so check out the collection at www.commonslibrary.org.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio 855 AM on the dial. Also, you can find us on the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au and the Community Radio Plus app if you're out and about. That song you just heard is called Paradigms by Sam Fender. We're now going to listen to an interview from friend of the show and host of the Kill Your Lawn, Kick Your Fence show, Amy Chiara. Speaking with Keir Patterson, who's the CEO of Community Houses and a longtime community volunteer, and they're speaking about neighbourhood houses, their safety for women and children, community programs, as well as an upcoming rally and the need for government funding to keep neighbourhood houses running.
So let's talk basics and let's talk about what is a neighborhood house specifically for those who are unfamiliar. Yeah. I'm very familiar. I love them, but let's start with basics.
Yeah, for sure. And look, a lot of people are unfamiliar with what happens at neighborhood houses, and obviously, like, we're trying to fix that. But neighborhood houses really started in the 70s when groups of women were organizing in their local areas. It's very grassroots for the safety and also like economic benefit of women and children. And so that was at a time, you know, in Melbourne when you could actually like fundraise and go and buy a house. So a lot of them did, and they became like safe places for women and children, and then like increasingly running like broader programs also for men, new migrants, people who might have disabilities, people who might have health issues, like basically anyone in society that may that needs a safe place to go. And so from that beginning has really like branched out over the last 50 years to, so there are 400 in Victoria. Every neighborhood house you go to is different because neighborhood houses follow a community development approach. So they try and meet the needs of their local community, and like every community is different. But you'll typically find like some, you know, arts classes, other types of classes that may be run by passionate volunteers from the community. There's a formal education program called Learn Locals that a lot of neighborhood houses are part of. So that's typically like English classes, digital literacy, numeracy, but a bunch of other things as well. A lot of them now run run some childcare. A lot of them will do.
They'll have a childcare center attached as well.
It has declined in our sector because like unfortunately the conditions are better for like big commercial childcare centers, but they often run like small community childcare. Some of them are a bit larger and really look like activity, walking groups, sporting. Like it really is incredibly diverse, whatever the community itself needs. And in fact, if you like, even if you got an idea for something that's not met in your community, if you go to the neighborhood house and you say, hey, I'd like to run an XYZ class, or I'd like to do this activity, you know, a lot of the times they'll say, yeah, like that's our culture. They'll say, go for it and we'll see if it works.
Yeah, I've been a gardener as a professional working for maintenance, and I've done contracted, a company I worked for, we worked for City of Melbourne. and we did neighborhood houses and childcares that were run by City of Melbourne.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And my one of my favorite neighborhood houses, I've become like a bit of a neighborhood house connoisseur.
we'll have to compare notes.
I don't know if it's going to stay because it's right next door to the housing blocks on Melrose Street. But on Melrose Street near the Royal Children's Hospital, I forget what the name of this neighborhood house is called, but there is a beautiful neighborhood house with a childcare center and like a maternity, it's all publicly run, maternity sort of women who've just had babies, I think, sort of center. And it is a bustling place. Whenever I turned up, because we would turn up randomly throughout the week, it was a bustling place. The staff and volunteers were incredible. There was a local Spanish-speaking community and the staff could speak Spanish. They were native speakers. And I would go there and there would be older folk just sitting, playing cards at the table, talking in their own languages. There's a beautiful Chinese women's choir that sings there on a regular basis and they have the most beautiful voices and they're just local members of the community. There's yoga classes. I noticed they're very common at a lot of neighborhood houses.
Yeah, that's right.
Pilates and yoga.
Yeah, Pilates, yoga, Qigong, all that sort of as it's like gentle exercise.
And it's just, I don't know what the future of it is going to be with the Melrose Towers, on the chopping block, but, just something very, just really beautiful. And the staff were incredible. I always felt incredibly welcome just as someone coming to tend to the gardens.
Yeah, that's great.
And they often have little community gardens attached to them, neighborhood houses.
Yeah, yeah. Correct. Yeah. In fact, there's something that a stat that always makes me happy, and at least it's still true. There are more community gardens in neighborhood houses in Victoria than there are McDonald's. So there are 167 community gardens. There are 166 McDonald's last time I checked. But that just goes to show, we often do fly under the radar. Obviously, everyone's heard of McDonald's. Not everyone's heard of neighborhood houses. Every neighborhood house might be called something different, so that can be the reason. But they're visited by 185,000 people a week in Victoria.
Wow. Yeah.
So we're very much like grassroots, at the heart of the community. I just wish more people could connect with neighborhood houses and be aware of it because I know how beneficial it is.
Another thing I'm organizing for this show with a group that does public transport issues is I'm going to be riding the bus networks and interviewing people on the bus and reviewing some of the bus routes that maybe could use improvement. One of the things that we were talking about at the meeting was how there's a push to make buses more environmentally friendly. We've got some amazing buses rolling out. But if there aren't people using the buses, which is more of a fault to do with how many buses there are and which directions they go to, it's more complex than just people not being interested. Then the politicians don't really see the value of continuing to allow funding for renewable buses. So I can imagine that, because I think that I agree with you. I think a lot of people don't know what neighborhood houses are or their potential value. And I think, I would love to see more people use them because they've been a lifeline. I used to live during a time when I was not very well. I used to live in Coburg and there's a beautiful neighborhood house on Reynard Street in Coburg.
I know it. Yeah. Not well.
It has a beautiful community garden. It has a bread pantry out the front. It has community coffee mornings.
Yeah, lunches. Yeah. I've been to the lunch there.
I was living there during COVID and that place was very special during that time. And it's the sort of community infrastructure that looks after anyone from the community.
That's right. Yeah. And I think COVID taught us how important social connection is.
Yeah.
If we were in any doubt. The science of social isolation and loneliness now has advanced a lot, and we know, the statistic that, that you always read, is that, you know, loneliness can be the equivalent of health equivalent of smoking 15 cigarettes a day. Mm. It is really serious. And so neighborhood houses are there really for a lot of people. Mm. That's their social connection. That's their connection to community. And what our like surveys that we do of neighborhood house participants show is that over 90% say that their emotional well-being, their physical well-being, and their mental health are all improved as a result of them going to the neighborhood house.
Yeah, that's so amazing. What a beautiful thing to be a part of.
Well, we have some challenges as well. Yeah. And that's like one of the things I wanted to come on and talk
about
to
the funding issues.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. So unfortunately, over the past 2 years, about half the neighborhood houses in Victoria have been running at a loss.
Mm.
And they run on pretty fine, like their finances are always pretty finely balanced anyway. Mm. So, you know, that is a situation that's really concerning to us as the peak body. We're calling on the government to increase the funding to what it would have been if it had been indexed properly to keep pace with costs. That's an $11.7 million increase for the year.
Mm-hmm.
But we say it's absolutely worth it because we know that for the like $40 million that neighborhood houses receive in core funding from the state government, we deliver $922 million in community value. That's community value that you can measure, whether it's social connection or the importance of food relief or job training, education. Mm. We deliver a huge amount of value for a small amount. Yeah. And so just imagine like if we were secure and the future was secure, like what we could actually achieve and save the state government money too. Mm.
Yeah, and, you know, of course, we live in some pretty austere times right now, the cost of living crisis, the housing crisis.
Exactly.
This is just vital, isn't it?
Yeah. And the other thing that I think doesn't get recognised also is that, like, neighbourhood houses, because as you've said, like, they're a safe space.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people... We actually refer a lot to external agencies. So if someone might come to the neighborhood house with, you know, they just to meet people or have a bit of social connection when they feel comfortable, they'll actually start to talk, well, I've got this issue or I've got this other issue, and they'll get referred to someone because it is that sort of safe place where it's based on relationships. You know, you're a person, you're not just there as a client or a patient.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've seen you walk into most neighborhood houses and there'll be somewhere quite like 3CR where you have a little board with all these little cards for connecting people. One of the shows here is called Vows, and it's an LGBT older persons program for helping them connect to people and getting health services and housing. And I seen their cards at different neighborhood houses when I was working.
Oh, fantastic.
In them. And I was just like, that made me so happy because you never know when there's an older person who might be part of the community or just discovering they're part of the community.
Yeah.
And to see that little card there, they can just take it and that, otherwise, they wouldn't come across that card in many other places. Mm. The other thing I think as well is like these places are also can be places of refuge in summer.
That is true, yeah. Although it's challenging because our opening hours, and we're not often funded to be open for long hours.
True.
But that is absolutely true. And actually a lot of some neighborhood houses have actually had like funding from charities, from philanthropy to stay open longer on hot days because that's, as we all know, like that's becoming a real issue.
Mm, absolutely. And we were just talking about an event, a rally.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, a rally to help bolster the funding of neighborhood houses. So, Kia, let's hear about this event.
Yeah, thank you. Over the last 4 or 5 months, we've been campaigning to have our funding shortfall fixed and in the next budget in May. So that's what we're aiming for. We have distributed thousands or tens of thousands of postcards for people to send to the minister, and we know that they're coming back now into her office. But
exciting.
It's really important that we show the whole of Parliament that that, you know, we're as strong as a sector and we're here and we're not going away and we're going to keep campaigning.
Yeah.
And so we've got a rally organised on the 18th of February at 12:30 on the steps of Parliament
yep.
to tell our parliamentarians to support neighbourhood houses and lobby the Treasurer to support our funding ask. And so we would love for anyone who wants to come along to support neighbourhood houses to be there. We'll have speeches. We'll have a bit of music.
Yep.
We'll have there'll be a lot of colour and movement. So mm-hmm. it'll be a really fun event. So and a really good opportunity to like show your support for grassroots community.
Yeah. Do you have any speakers lined up?
We've got neighbourhood house speakers. Yep. So we've got our president, Beth Davidson, who's elected by the membership, yep. and then we've also got a number of neighbourhood houses speaking. We've got people coming from like as far away as Redcliffes.
Oh wow.
Up in the Mallee and so like and all over Victoria. So yeah, we're really keen to hear from them. I'm really, really keen for their message to be heard by Parliament.
And so what's the general goal? So we raise the money, hopefully we get the money from the government. And say the best case scenario that happens, what does future,
I mean, that'll secure the future of neighborhood houses. So we won't have any close. We'll also, what we're seeing at the moment is that opening hours are being cut to save costs.
Mm.
And so opening hours for neighborhood houses now are at their lowest point in 10 years.
Right.
Because of the lack of funding. And so, you know, it's the community that misses out from that.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, that if we're able to get the funding increase that we need, not only will it mean that people's, you know, jobs are secure, the neighbourhood houses themselves are secure, but it also create a bit of funding to run programs, even just like, you know, pay the electricity bill, keep the doors open, those sorts of things. So it's not very glamorous, but those are some of the things that, you know, we absolutely need that funding for.
Oh, amazing. Yeah. So, Kia, was there anything else you wanted to say before we finish up?
Yeah, just one more thing, which was we also, if you can't make it to the rally, another way that you can show your support is by sending an e-postcard.
Yep.
We have physical postcards and I'll leave a stack of them here at 3CR. Amazing. If you want to pop in and grab one, that would be great.
Yeah.
If you're not able to do that though, then please go on www.nhvic.org.au. We have a click on the campaign page there, and there's a link there to a digital postcard that you can send to our Minister Roz Spence to tell her and tell the Treasurer of Victoria, Jacqueline Symes, to restore our funding to where it should have been and secure the future of neighbourhood houses.
That was 3CR reporter Amy Chiara speaking with Keir Patterson, who is the CEO of Community Houses and longtime community volunteer, speaking about the importance of neighbourhood housing and their campaign for government funding to keep neighbourhood houses running. For more info about the campaign and to find your local neighbourhood house, go to nhvic.org.au. Their upcoming rally is on the 18th of February at 12:30 p.m. at Parliament Steps. And, of course, you can listen to more from our comrade Amy Chiara and her wonderful show, Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence, at 3cr.org.au/killyourlawn or tune in live to 3CR on Fridays from 9 till 10 a.m. Next up on the Monday Breakfast Show, we're going to listen to the first half of a conversation that Jan Bartlett had on her first show back from the summer break of the Tuesday Home Time show, where she speaks with Kathy Kelly, who is a veteran US human rights activist, about the climate of fear and intimidation in her country, as well as the recent actions of ICE, and they draw some comparisons to Germany in the 1930s.
We're increasingly aware of the impact of the errati president of the United States, Donald Trump, on many countries of the world, and indeed the stability of world politics and economy. But today the focus is on the impact of the citizens of the United States, certainly not the upper echelons of society, who, unlike the vast majority, have increased their wealth in past year, notably the fortunes of the Trump family and hangers-on. But for the vast majority of the country, life has become more difficult in many ways and shows no signs of improving in the short term. I spoke on Monday morning with lifelong activist and writer Kathy Kelly for an understanding of the situation there at the moment, and she is in Chicago. Kathy, I would imagine that if you need one example of how far the climate of fear and repression is present in the United States, is the military and the paramilitary forces known as ICE on the streets of the cities. This is not a new thing in the United States history, but how far back do we need to go for an equivalent period of time when the military and paramilitary can roam the streets of the US city and sweep people up off the streets to who knows where?
Well, certainly in the United States, one of the world's largest carceral systems or prison systems has been building over many decades. And certainly we had enslavement and segregation and the denial of right to vote for women and child labor. But I think that what's happening right now is, in a sense, characterized well by the notion of a boomerang or the canary in the coal mine, because the things that an imperial United States government would do in other countries, to other countries, has now truly come home. And so forces and practices that violated people's human rights in places like Palestine and across the global South are now being unleashed in a way that almost seems random in cities across the United States. You know, we see that people are being under surveillance, state surveillance, sanctioned, expelled from schools, fired from their jobs, beaten and arrested by police and abducted by ICE, deported. And sometimes, you know, I mean, a five-year-old child was deported, and they, you know, where are people being taken? We don't always know. And the government slanders the victims who try to defend human rights. And now, you know, we find that those who try to stand up to ICE agents could be punished by death. The death of Alex Preti the night before last, the death of Rene Good. And ICE agents send people to detention centers where they can also be killed. Raul Lucan Campos, his last words were, "No puedo respirar, I can't breathe." And meanwhile, President Trump calls the ICE agents patriots, and he insists that the victims pose terrorist threats. So I think what we're seeing now is a similarity between the kinds of abuses that the United States provisioned Israel to commit against Palestinians and what people are at risk of if they go up against the ICE agents and other armed militias in the United States.
How long do you think this has been in the planning?
For many years, police departments in major cities have gone over to Israel for their training. And there's a person named Rory Fanning who had been in the U.S. military in Afghanistan. And he is now identifying people that were part of the kinds of night raids and death squad practices in Afghanistan. And he, you know, as he scrutinizes video that's coming from Minneapolis, he's seeing that, you know, people are sort of recycled. They come back from military operations and, you know, they aren't sure where to find work. And the ICE salaries can be pretty lucrative. So I think the fact that the United States has been for years pouring money into militarism, both coming from the Pentagon or organized by city militias or by ICE, made it predictable that this kind of thing would happen. And we can trace it back through successive administrations that continued to build up these military budgets and to wage drone warfare abroad and continue training many, many people to use weapons. I mean, one very personal anecdote that I'm troubled by is that a good friend of mine has for years been agonizing over the PTSD that his son has suffered from upon return from Iraq, where he was deployed with the U.S. military. And the son got work in construction. But the construction projects he's been involved in have relied very, very much on Latinos as co-workers. And now so many of them have been deported or, you know, are at risk if they show up for work, that the projects have been pretty much, you know, laid to rest. And so this young man, this veteran with very severe PTSD, now doesn't have work. And how could he get work? Well, maybe ICE would be an option. But then many of these traumatized veterans who go to work for ICE, you know, when they feel threatened, they see themselves back in Afghanistan, back in Iraq. So it just stands to reason that there will be more abuse, more violence. And, of course, in cities across the United States, people are saying, we can't put up with this. We have to turn out. And I hope there will be general strikes all across the United States.
What's been the situation in Chicago?
Well, Chicagoans were fairly successful in finally persuading the Trump administration to send the ICE agents out. People used whistles to notify one another that an ICE vehicle had been spotted, and people would turn out, you know, using social media in the hundreds and then the thousands, and still the abolish ICE demonstrations in solidarity with Minneapolis are going strong, and we find that also in Los Angeles and in St. Louis and New York. So I think that there's a rising rebellion. Unfortunately, the strongest movement is called Indivisible, and it's a movement funded and organized by Democrats. And I think whether it's Democrat or Republican, we've got kind of a uniparty support for militarism in this country. So it would be great if the people that have been turning out for these Indivisible No More Kings rallies would instead invoke a peace charter and say, we don't want militarism, whether it's the Democratic version or the Republican version.
You've mentioned a couple of cities there where ICE has been operating. Why is it so bad in Minnesota?
There was a very strong Black Lives Matter movement in Minnesota. Minnesota is a blue state. And, of course, Minnesota is the state where George Floyd was killed when he was asphyxiated by guards who knelt on him and cut off his breathing, even though he begged them and said, I can't breathe. But I think that Minnesotans have had more experience, particularly in Minneapolis, than in most states with organized neighborhood grassroots resistance. You know, perhaps President Trump and the ICE agents thought, well, we have to make an example of this. But, you know, Erica Chenoweth and Maria Stephan have said that if 3.5% of a population are really and truly organized, they can and have many times overthrown fascist dictatorships or authoritarian oligarchies, bulligarchy it's sometimes called these days. Well, most places are not as organized, really, as people in Minneapolis, Minnesota. But they are certainly showing an example. And if that can be replicated elsewhere, we might find that people will sense the strength that comes from grassroots organized community action. And, you know, in a way, when I think about the notion of a canary in the coal mine, I think about what's happened to people in Gaza and in the West Bank. And they've been pummeled so hideously that it's almost impossible for people to organize at this point. But I think if we look to what's happened there, we certainly can see what this administration is capable of doing and supporting with its allies. Now, we should also note that the United States has Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for an ally, but it's losing the number of allies it can count on. And China, meanwhile, has a much more robust economy.
What impact do you believe this is having on young children? I mean, you talk about Palestine and the other countries where it's devastated the young people. But in the United States, when you've got 2-3-year-olds facing up to balaclava-clad men in black with guns.
Yeah, you know, I feel very, very sad thinking about what kind of future children are facing when they've got armed guards entering into their schools, out on their playgrounds, threatening their teachers. It's a very strong theft, really, of childhood, because children aren't allowed to be children if they have to live in fear and anxiety and preoccupation. And I was thinking today about a Dr. Ezdin in Gaza, who just wrote his reflections after going to visit a school in northern Gaza in a place called Jabalia. It's a school that's really a network of 20 tents. And when he went to the school, he was appalled that there are 1,184 school children being educated in these 20 tents. And the only way it can be done is to have three-hour shifts. So the children come for 3 hours, and then they go, and another group comes in, and that group is replaced. And each group only goes to the school for 3 days a week. So in a sense, education is being rationed in this school. And then the doctor inquired, well, how many of these children are orphans? And the answer was 181. In just one school, there were 181 children who have no father, no mother, no roof over their head, no shoulder to lean on. And so those children are being robbed of their childhood also. They experience a loss of safety, a loss of the right to grow healthfully. And so a crime is really being committed against an entire generation of young Palestinians. But I think that same mentality is being aimed against children who are already impacted by the tremendous inequality in the United States.
Hello, 3CR listeners. I'm Giselle Hanna from Accent of Women and Asia Pacific Currents, and I'm appealing to you to subscribe to 3CR to keep radical voices on air. I've been a volunteer and broadcaster at 3CR for over 20 years, and I can say categorically that radical voices like ours that bring you stories of extraordinary, incredible women from across the world leading grassroots struggles, well, those voices just aren't welcome in the mainstream media. You won't hear about the struggle against Samsung's human rights abuses against its workers in South Korea. You won't hear about the plight of the Myanmar resistance against the coup on any other station, at least not the way we tell it here at 3CR. So be a comrade and go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe or call the station on 9419 8377.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio. It is 51 minutes past 7 on the 9th of February. The segment you heard before that announcement was the first half of a conversation between Jan Bartlett and a human rights activist, Kathy Kelly, about the climate of fear and intimidation in the US, focusing particularly on the recent actions of ICE and comparing them to the to that in Germany in the 1930s. The second half of the interview will be played next week, but of course you can hear more from Jan at 3cr.org.au/hometime-tuesday, or of course tune in live to 3CR on Tuesdays from 4 p.m. We're now going to be speaking to Tamsin from the Fly By Night Bat Clinic, which is a volunteer-run wildlife rescue organization dedicated to the rescue, rehabilitation, and release of threatened species. And we'll be speaking about a number of grey-haired flying foxes living in Brimbank Park who tragically died over January as a result of Victoria's recent record-breaking temperatures, despite volunteer efforts to save them. Good morning, Tamsin.
Good morning, Rob. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much for waking up early to speak with us. Tamsin, do you want to just start by telling us about the grey-haired flying foxes and their importance within ecosystems?
Yes, so the grey-headed flying foxes are a threatened species. They I got a bit of an echo.
That's
so
okay.
The grey-headed flying foxes are a threatened species that pollinate our eucalyptus, so, and native plants and fruits. So a lot of people don't know that they're actually a main pollinator of eucalyptus, which is our gums, our unique forests. They travel great distances across states to do that job and do that cross-pollination. So they're actually very important to the ecosystem. They're sort of a keystone species as well. So if we lose them, we lose a number of other species, including the koala. So we really try to educate and advocate for this species.
So talk to me a little bit about how extreme temperatures, such as the ones we saw in January, affect the species?
Unfortunately, with any species or any animal being in such extreme temperatures, so it got to around 46, it's not really great for life, for anything outside. Unfortunately, over about 40 degrees in the Victorian temperature, it's quite dry and hot, and they succumb very quickly to the extreme temperatures that we unfortunately had recently. And because there's no humidity and it's just so dry, they really suffer in the heat.
Obviously, as we said at the top of the interview, the Fly By Night Bat Clinic is volunteer run, and by extension, the response to the deaths of these grey-headed flying foxes was conducted by volunteers. What does the response on the ground look like for the volunteers? And
So unfortunately, in January, it was around about the 7th. There is the department DECA have said that they would look after the grey-headed flying foxes in times of extreme heat. Unfortunately, Brimbank Park wasn't part of their scope. They weren't resourced for it, even with us trying to get help for them at that camp, because we knew that it was going to be such a hot day and there was no water, irrigation or resources around that space. So we unfortunately got a phone call to say that there was a lot of dying animals on that day in the afternoon. And grey-headed flying foxes, when they start to get really hot, they sort of come down the trunks of the trees and they come together as they're sort of delirious from the heat. They start off with just minor flapping, but as it gets hotter, they come closer together, and then they it's sort of like comfort that they're together, but then they inadvertently suffocate themselves. So, it gets worse for them. So when we, when the volunteers got there, unfortunately, it was already quite a number that were already deceased. A lot of babies on their deceased mothers. So it's really quite distressing for anyone to be there. It's very traumatic to see animals suffering in number. It's horrible for anyone to see any animal suffering, but when you see such large quantities of animals, and we're talking about 800 animals, it's quite, it's something you never sort of lose. You see it and you can't get rid of it. And then obviously we've got to keep going as volunteers. We're still getting animals being called in after the fact in illegal fruit tree netting, barbed wire, hit by car, electrocution, and then we're still looking after these little ones that have mums have passed during that heat. And then obviously we had another horrible hot day 2 weeks later, so we had more time to try and push for additional resources for that site. So that was where we had volunteers coming in with backpacks, sprayers to wet down the area, so you raise that humidity in that space and change the ambient temperature. And that was what we were aiming to do, and we had significantly less losses with that water just being in place.
And how did the has there been any response from DECA, the Department of Energy, Environment and Climate Action, from them about more resources being allocated to Brimbank Park?
At this stage, no. I think with in between those two heat events, we obviously made a lot of there was a lot of media regarding it, and we were able to get a DECA to source a water tank for us. So we got about 71,000 litres out in that area of water, but there has been no further discussions or collaboration or communication around what it'll be like in the future. There's multiple departments involved, and we just want to be able to collaborate to make sure everyone's on the same page on what we can do if we do have another heat event this season, which would be quite exhausting for us as volunteers, but we'll do our best to save as many as we can. So, because they are, they're essentially our nighttime bees. So they're doing a very important job at night, a lot of people don't know the flowers open at night on our eucalyptus, and that's where the flying foxes will go and do that pollinating job.
Mm. So what would the support from DECA look like?
Well, as they're in charge of that space, so they have the end say of our, because they're a threatened species, as well as they do the camp management plans. We would hope that they would do. It's sort of too late this season to do anything permanently structurally for irrigation. It would be too stressful on the animals anyway, but it would be that same situation of having available water on site and working with us and the volunteers to allow that help to those animals without restriction, because it can a lot of politics and policy and other things can get in the way of actually doing the job of saving animals. So it makes it really difficult when we've got so many barriers we've got to get through to even be able to help them.
I just have one more question before I let you go, Tamzin. I just wanted to ask how the volunteers and flying foxes themselves are recovering.
Yeah, so look, the volunteers, we haven't really stopped, so we haven't really had a chance to really think about. We've just got to keep getting on. We rely on the community's assistance financially and support-wise, so we are just trying to continue to do what we do every day, which is rescue the flying foxes when they're in predicaments, like I said, the fruit tree netting and other scenarios, and then prep as we can best to have the right equipment, you know, PPE, safety, protection for us, as well as being ready to house animals to get them back out as soon as we can. But for the flying foxes, it's sort of dire. We try not to get too upset and negative around how we feel like we're just doing the same thing every day without that support from government or other areas where we need like council and parks to really work together to support them.
And how can listeners who might want to support the clinic and your efforts to help keep this species alive, how can they support the clinic?
Yeah, thank you. The best thing at the moment is obviously, you know, it's the same thing for everyone, but it is monetary. So you can either help us with purchasing items that we can get for future events, as well as feeding the animals that are in care. So it's a high expense when it comes for substitute food and supplements for the flying foxes. We've got, wish lists on Amazon, but we, have GoFundMe. You can go to our website, flybynight.org.au. But we're also on Facebook and Instagram. But we, if you're looking at wanting to volunteer down the track, we can also discuss how you can get involved. But it would be when we're sort of at a quieter point, because we're trying to just do what we can with the very limited time we have.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll be sure to put a link to the clinic's website and how folks can donate into the show notes for the podcast that we upload for the show. But thank you so much for joining us, Tamsin, and best of luck with your efforts.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate you having me on. And yes, I hope today is not too hot.
Thank you. Me too. That was Tamsin, a member of the Fly By Night Clinic, talking to us about the importance of the grey-headed flying fox, as well as volunteers' desperate attempts to keep populations alive during NAM's recent record-breaking temperatures. You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio. Stay tuned.
3CR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
When I was new to Melbourne, I found a Food Not Bombs flyer on the road, and I had like this fist with a carrot, and carrots are my favourite vegetable. Yeah, I think they were asking for help doing stuff, and I got in touch.
We, I guess, rescue food
that would otherwise go to waste.
I like the aspect of sharing food and not making anyone feel obligated to pay anything for it.
We make a real point at Food Not Bombs of involving everyone who wants to be involved in whichever part they want to be involved in.
For more information, go to fnbmelb.noblogs.org. Food Not Bombs is a 3CR supporter.
Forests are essential ecosystems, mitigating for climate breakdown, cooling the planet, and preserving the wondrous diversity of life. Yet, they are being destroyed at an alarming rate. Here in the Kulin Nations, logging continues, increasing risk of both fires and floods. The Bob Brown Foundation is calling a national day of action, the March in March for Forests. In Naam, join us on Sunday, the 22nd of March at 11 a.m. in Parliament Gardens to demand the protection for native forests. Go to marchforforests.org for all the details, including how to volunteer. March for Forests, Sunday, the 22nd of March at 11 a.m.
A 3CR supporter.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show. It is the 9th of February and it is 7 minutes past 8 in the morning. Hope everyone is having a good morning and enjoying the show. For our last segment of the show, we will be speaking with Stephen Roberts about a study they have co-authored titled The Reanimation of Normative Manhood Acts in Schools, Teachers' Accounts of Boys' Manosphere Aggravated Misogyny. The study analyzes the ways in which masculinity is being performed by boys in schools and how that performance is shaped by so-called manosphere influences, such as Andrew Tate, through the lens of teachers. Stephen Roberts is a masculinity researcher and professor of sociology at Monash University. Good morning, Stephen. Thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So maybe let's start with some definitions here for folks who aren't aware. What is normative manhood and what exactly is the manosphere?
So I'll start with the latter. So the manosphere is this collection of online characters and figures who sort of promote particular ways of being a man. And then the normative part of that is that they promote it in such a way that they want it to be normalized and celebrated. But the way that these things are celebrated is through and promoting is misogyny, effectively. So a particular type of traditional masculinity, regressive masculinity that kind of aspires to return to previous gender relations if they'd ever gone away, of course. But they kind of celebrate, yeah, traditional 1950s-style gender relations where men have a dominance in kind of gender hierarchy. So that's the main thing that the manosphere is kind of doing. And the normative part of that, the manhood act, as it were, which is a kind of, it's an academic term, but the idea really is that it's a, yeah, again, a kind of normalizing and promotion of particular types of behavior that's kind of calibrated as being particularly masculine and the way that men and boys should be.
And what were teachers telling you and your colleagues about how the manosphere has affected boys and their behavior in schools?
So the first thing to note is that we're not just describing everyday misbehavior here, but a noticeable shift in the way that boys express masculinity. So we also know that misogyny has been kind of embedded and baked into school cultures for a long, long time and into society, of course. But they're talking about, teachers are talking about a more collective, more confident kind of approach to misogyny where boys are increasingly not concerned by consequences. And they also talked about how this has become an escalation over time and visible with a coincidence of the mainstreaming of manosphere ideas, which kind of kicks in around 2020 to 2022. And they're telling us that essentially this is increased form of misogyny. And we've kind of separated it in our paper across five different, what we call manhood acts. We did this for analytic purposes to try and divide them up. But really what we're talking about is like entitlement, dominance, and hostility towards women that's being performed in classrooms and playgrounds, and that teachers are describing as yet kind of loss of shame, loss of fear, loss of worry about consequences.
And what was there a specific age range which had been sort of affected more or in particular by this manosphere of influences?
Yes, yeah, so that's a super interesting question. So typically we know that we're looking teenagers, like young teenagers seems to be the target audience or the target concern, I suppose, because that's where we see the manosphere as kind of having the most traction. But in the research that we've done across two blocks of research, actually, we find also that these behaviors are becoming prominent in primary school settings as well. So what we know, of course, is that Australia's social media delay will have some kind of impact here because under 16s are technically not permitted to engage with manosphere content that appears on social media. But there's all kinds of workarounds. And the fact is, I think what's really crucial from this paper is that across the age range, what we're talking about here is a legacy of the mainstreaming of the manosphere as well. So even if, and this is the case in this research, people are not necessarily invoking the language of, for example, Andrew Tate. They're not using his name as often, although they still are. The kind of things, the attitudes that people like Andrew Tate have popularized have become really prominent. And again, across settings, across, so not just age range, but also across different types of schools. So whether that's independent school, public schools, or religious affiliated schools, this is really present. And the experience is kind of more common for younger teachers probably, or earlier career teachers, but even teachers with 15 or 20 years experience in this piece of research told us that it feels worse than ever.
Did you have much interaction with the schools themselves that these teachers work at? I'd be curious to know if and how they reacted knowing the behavior of students was being examined.
Yeah, no, the research is based like solely on the accounts of the teachers who have experienced misogyny. And one of this is interesting, I think, because actually if we try to go into schools, A, there's a whole kind of different ethics process that takes a lot longer, and schools might be resistant to researchers coming in to explore this kind of stuff. And certainly every time we do this kind of research, including this one, teachers have to remain anonymous. So we can't explicitly talk about which school it was. We have to take the word of the teacher to say this is the school that they work at. And the reason for that is the way the kind of policy works, basically, is that teachers are not allowed to talk about these types of things that happen with their job, or indeed lots of things that happen with their job, in a public setting without permission of the department. So the Department of Education. So what we find here is that teachers are extremely reluctant, extremely scared, actually, of talking about their experience in a way that would identify them, the fear of losing their job. So they kind of get caught from both ends, a problem that's emerging through and with their engagement with boys in particular, but then also not being able to speak to this problem in case they get in trouble. And then a third part of that is, in all of the accounts that we kind of analyze, we see this strong pattern of, we call it institutional gaslighting. So a collective kind of enterprise on behalf of leadership where women's accounts are kind of undermined or ignored or pushed back on them and told that, you know, this is probably to do with your own behavior management technique rather than explicitly addressing or even conceding that there's a cultural problem within the schools and beyond.
Do you think that that response in and of itself is a result of the manosphere?
I don't think necessarily that is a result of the manosphere. I think it's like one step removed from that. This is a condition of a misogynistic patriarchal society. So we, in schools, we have a situation where it's vast majority of teachers are women, but that doesn't kind of translate into the gendered proportions at the level of leadership. So we have a situation where leaders are mostly men and probably just don't get it, to be honest. Like the gender power relations are such that men's ignorance and therefore leadership's ignorance of these issues, I think, is present and has been present for a long time. I think it's also crucial to say that women teachers, women leaders also engage in this kind of denial as well quite often, and minimization. So it's more like a leadership versus women teachers kind of thing, rather than that the manosphere has influenced school responses. But there is something about how schools have not yet, the school leadership have not yet come to grip necessarily with the impact and the transformation that the manosphere has manifested.
And in your in the study, you mentioned that the rise has been particularly prevalent since 2023, right? So there's been some time for schools to sort of wrap their heads around how to respond to this.
Yeah, and I think they are as well. So one of the pieces of work we do at Monash is like a teacher training program for schools to help develop literacy around this issue. And we know there are other types of programs as well across the country that work on trying to develop healthier masculinities amongst boys and young men in school settings, and others, again, that do something similar to what we're doing in terms of like building that capacity to address this issue. So I think we are getting there. The effect has become more in focus, but certainly it's taken its time. And we know that because actually the manosphere itself has been around for a long, long time. And its particular articulation, like its contemporary articulation, has certainly been around for 5 to 7 years, and its effects have been felt for at least 5 years. So I think we've been slow to accept this kind of thing as a problem. And typically what we see from a kind of policymaker response is, oh, yeah, we're already doing that work. We're doing the work of intervening on the grounds of, for example, respectful relationships education. And one of the challenges there is that respectful relationships education is an evidence-based approach to teaching kids to be more aware of gender relations and behave respectfully, as the title says, and to combat misogyny. But the implementation of those programs is uneven, and investment is often weak. So there are things that schools and the government, state and federal, have been trying to do, but our kind of the laser sharp focus that's required and the kind of intense commitment that is required to combat this has been lacking.
Right. I'm also curious to know if I know that you spoke with 107 people to gather the data for your survey. I'm wondering if you gathered any data on how many of those were like gender diverse or transgender and how their experiences may be differentiated.
Yeah, so that's super interesting. And we're really, really keen to investigate this further because in this data set, so the survey was sent out and we invited written kind of accounts of people's experience of sexism, misogyny, and the manosphere and its kind of radicalization of boys in the teaching workplace. And it was the vast majority of respondents were identified as women, which we kind of expect because that parallels with the proportions in schools more broadly. But we did have a handful of men identifying participants and then a smaller number again of gender diverse participants. And the gender diverse participants actually speak to very, very similar themes across the data set. So nothing that's explicit, but I think in a way our capacity to investigate that further is limited by the method, which was we just took the written account of we gave people one question and they kind of addressed the question in their own way, and then they send us what they wanted to write and we analyze that. So there are some, for example, some explicit accounts from cisgender women who are very kind of very similar to the gender diverse accounts in the sense of talking about the presence of transphobia and so on in the classroom. So there's a recognition across gender categories in that sense, across gender identity.
That's pretty much all we have time for, Stephen. But thank you so much for joining us on the Monday Breakfast Show.
My pleasure.
That was Stephen Roberts, who is a masculinity researcher and professor of sociology at Monash University, speaking to us about a research article they co-authored titled "The Reanimation of Normative Manhood Acts in Schools: Teachers' Accounts of Boys' Manosphere Aggravated Misogyny." If this is something that interests you, our comrades at the Yena Pasaran show interviewed another of the study's co-authors about the impact of Andrew Tate on Australian classrooms back in May of 2024, Dr. Stephanie Westcott, and we'll put the link to that show in the show notes, as well as the study that we mentioned in our interview with Stephen. Stay tuned.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Awesome.
3CR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show. That song you heard before that announcement was Samaritans by Idols, about toxic masculinity.
Yeah.
Which brings us to the end of the show. It is 8:25. But given it's the 9th of February, we thought we'd quickly remind all of our listeners out there that 3CR's subscriber drive starts today. Of course, 3CR couldn't be what it does, couldn't be doing what it does without the support of the community, as after all, it is a community radio station.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, community support means we don't have to rely on corporations, or we don't have to take money from the mainstream media, or even necessarily say what they want us to say,
mm-hmm.
you know, and perpetuate imperialism and colonialism.
That's it.
As elsewhere in the media so often does.
Mm.
So if you're not a subscriber and you haven't, or if you haven't subscribed this year, you can subscribe at 3cr.org.au/subscribe, or you can also call up the station and we'll be happy to help you do that at 03-9419-8377, or even come into the studio.
Come in. We'll show you around.
Yeah, say hello.
You could get a little subscriber card if Ooh. You wanted to.
That's very fun.
And you have it in your wallet and it's really cute.
You just pull it out in conversations.
Like, yeah, I'm a 3CR subscriber. You could buy a sticker. You could come and get a t-shirt.
Buy a t-shirt.
Nice. You know,
come be a part of the 3CR
it's
family.
It's a community radio show. Be a part of the community.
Exactly. And you know, like, we can't run without your help. And, you know, and it feels good to donate and be a part of the community and to support community radio. It feels good for you.
Absolutely,
for your heart
it does.
And soul. That we have, you know, concession low-income subscriber options. And
yep.
Also, if you're a part of an organization, there's an organization subscriber option, I think.
Yeah, and there's also a solidarity one if you really love 3CR.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's that option too.
Yes.
For all of the beautiful people who want to show solidarity with 3CR.
Yes.
Anyway, we've only got 2 minutes left of the show. So, yeah, as we said before, you can subscribe at 3cr.org.au/subscribe. Call us up, come into the studio. We're on Smith Street, 21 Smith Street to be exact.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and this evening at Flinders Street at 5:30, it's very important you show up to be a part of the National Day of Action against the Israeli President Herzog's arrival and his visit with politicians across the continent. So that's happening at 5:30 p.m. at Flinders Street, and yeah, be a part of that voice against genocide and people mm-hmm. who exacerbate and perpetuate it.
Mm-hmm.
And one other last thing in that same vein, this Thursday Herzog will be in Nam. So this Thursday, the 12th of February, from 3 p.m., be at Southern Cross. And, yeah, please be on there. Please be there on time, because as we've seen in New South Wales with their repression against the protests, there may be a bit of a response here in Victoria as well. So that's happening at 3 p.m. this Thursday. And, yeah, show your support to say that the president of a nation currently conducting genocide is not welcome here.
Mm-hmm.
And we just have 30 seconds left of the show, so I'll just do a very quick outro. We heard Amy from Kill Your Lawn, Kick Your Fence speaking with Keir Patterson about the importance of neighbourhood houses. We heard Jan Bartlett speak with Kathy Kelly about the actions of ICE and the climate of fear and intimidation in the US, as well as the effects of the recent heat wave in so-called Victoria on the grey-headed flying foxes camp in Brimbank Park. And we also spoke about the effects of the manosphere aggravated misogyny on boys in schools and on teachers. Stay tuned for Women on the Line, and we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bye. 3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.